funds, such as Keith owns, would amount to annual fees of 0.3% each year. This is slightly cheaper than TD Bank's E-Series funds, but the savings might not be worth the trouble. You can decide by weighing the relative size of your account with the savings. On a $100,000 account, ETFs such as Keith's cost $300 a year in hidden expenses. On a $100,000 account, E-Series indexes would cost $400 a year in hidden expenses. The $100 annual savings on a $100,000 account wouldn't be worth the hassle if you were adding regularly to your account. Here's why. If you invest every month, you'll have to pay a brokerage fee of $9.99 for each online purchase with ETFs, and more than that if your account value is below $100,000. That monthly $9.99 adds up to nearly $120 a year. So if your account value doesn't easily exceed $100,000, you're better off with the E-Series index funds because they don't charge a commission to buy or sell. Table 6.6 shows the costs associated with buying monthly E-Series indexes, which have higher expense ratios but no commission fees, versus buying exchange-traded funds, which have lower expense ratios but charge purchase commissions. Table 6.6, total costs of an ETF portfolio versus a TD Bank E-Series portfolio. Account size, $100,000. Annual exchange-traded fund expense of 0.3%, $300. Annual E-Series index expense of 0.4%, $400. Cost to buy 12 times a year for exchange-traded funds, $119.88. Annual costs slash savings with exchange-traded funds compared with E-Series indexes, negative $19.88. $200,000. ETF expense, $600. E-Series expense, $800. Cost to buy ETFs per year, $119.88. Annual costs slash savings, $80.12. $300,000. ETF expense, $900. E-Series expense, $1,200. Cost to buy ETFs per year, $119.88. Annual costs slash savings, $180.12. $400,000. ETF expense, $1,200. E-Series expense, $1,600. Cost to buy ETFs per year, $119.88. Annual costs slash savings, $280.12. $500,000. ETF expense, $1,500. E-Series expense, $2,000. Cost to buy ETFs per year, $119.88. Annual costs slash savings, $380.12. $600,000. ETF expense, $1,800. E-Series expense, $2,400. Cost to buy ETFs per year, $119.88. Annual costs slash savings, $480.12. $700,000. ETF expense, $2,100. E-Series expense, $2,800. Cost to buy ETFs per year, $119.88. Annual costs slash savings, $580.12. Investing in ETFs does have a cost advantage once an investment account clears about $120,000, but it does require a bit more work on the part of the investor. Also, if the investor's account isn't well above $120,000, and if they make more than 12 purchases in a year, the cost savings can swing back in favor of the E-Series funds. Note from Table 6.6 that a $700,000 ETF account would save $580.12 a year compared with an E-Series indexed account, even after paying $9.99 a month, $119.88 a year, in annual commission fees. To purchase exchange-traded index funds, an investor has to open a discount brokerage account. There are a variety of Canadian brokerage firms offering this service, including TD Waterhouse, www.tdcanada.com/easyweb5/start/tdw/get_started.jsp. CIBC's Investor's Edge, www.investorsedge.cibc.com/ie/home.jsp. The Royal Bank Action Direct, www.rbcdirectinvesting.com/ and QTrade Investor, www.qtrade.ca/. Commission fees differ, but it's a competitive market and fees are falling. If you're still interested in ETFs and you want to buy like Keith, you'll have to purchase the following indexes off the Toronto Stock Exchange via your brokerage. The indexes before each respective index represent the code you'll need to enter, called a ticker symbol, before making each purchase. XIU equals Canadian Stock Index. XBB equals Canadian Bond Index. XIN equals International Stock Index. XSP equals U.S. Stock Index. Whether you buy the E-Series index funds from TD Bank or whether you opt for brokerage-purchased ETF indexes, you'll beat the pants off the majority of the pros, just as Keith has. Indexing in Singapore. A couple builds a tiger's portfolio in the Lion City. Singaporeans looking to invest in low-cost indexes might Google their options online. But like hidden vipers in the jungles of the Lion City, there are snakes in the financial service industry waiting to venomously erode your investment potential. Googling Singapore index funds will bring you to a company offering index funds that charge nearly 1% a year. That might seem insignificant, and that's exactly what marketers want you to believe. Paying 1% for an index fund can cost you hundreds of thousands of wasted dollars over an investment lifetime. Singaporean index fund retailer FundSupermart, www.fundsupermart.com/main/home/index.svdo, flogs the Infinity Investment Series. It offers an S&P 500 index fund, www.fundsupermart.com/main/fund_info/view-fund.svdo?SE$370283, number sign charge, charging 0.97% annually as an expense ratio, and they charge up to an additional 2% front-end sales fee to make the purchase. Let's assume that two Singaporean sisters decide to invest in a U.S. index. One of them buys the S&P 500 index fund through FundSupermart, while the other chooses to go with Vanguard's low-cost S&P 500 exchange-traded index fund that charges just 0.09% annually, which they can buy through Singapore's DBS Vickers brokerage firm. Before fees, each fund would make the same return because they track exactly the same market. Costs, when presented in tiny amounts, like 0.97%, look minimal. But they're not. Table 6.7 shows how seemingly small fees can kill investment profits over a lifetime. Table 6.7. Two sisters invest SGD $20,000. $20,000 given to each sister to invest for 35 years. Sister 1 invests in an S&P 500 index fund that costs 0.97% annually. Sister 2 invests in a Vanguard S&P 500 exchange-traded fund via DBS Vickers that costs 0.09% annually. Assume an 8% return for the S&P 500 index for the next 30 years. Sister 1 makes 7.03% annually after expenses. Sister 2 makes 7.91% annually after expenses. How much will each sister have after 35 years? Sister 1 will have $215,637.05. Sister 2 will have $287,203.17. After 40 years, assuming the same rate of return, Sister 1 will have $302,866.34. Sister 2 will have $420,240.29. After 45 years, assuming the same rate of return, Sister One will have $425,381.54. Sister Two will have $614,902.36. If the U.S. S&P 500 index makes 5% a year for the next 5 years, an investor paying just 0.97% is giving away nearly 20% of her profits every year. It's hard to imagine that over 45 years, the true cost of such small fees can amount to more than a $180,000 difference on just a $20,000 investment. Costs matter, and you don't want the industry to fool you with small percentages. Singapore residents embrace their indexing journey. Seng Soo Lin and Gordon Sear met in 2001 while volunteering at the Special Olympics in Singapore. Gordon teaches at Singapore American School, and Seng Soo Lin, who goes by Sue, teaches technical writing at Singapore Polytechnic and at the National University of Singapore while busily pursuing her PhD in psycholinguistics, the study of how humans acquire and use language. The couple married in 2008, and Gordon, originally from Canada, looked over his investments with frustration. He explained his concerns. "I used to teach in Kenya, and the school mandated that we invest our money with one of two companies. One of them was an offshore investment company called Zurich International Life Limited, www.zurich.com/international/singapore/home/welcome.htm, headquartered on the Isle of Man. They invested in actively managed funds, but I started to feel cheated. Before opening the account, I clearly asked the representative if I could have control of how much or how little I was investing, and he said that I could. But after some time had passed, I wanted to stop contributing. The statements were really confusing. I couldn't see how much I had deposited over time, and it was tough to see what my account was even worth." Feeling uncomfortable, Gordon thought it would be easy to stop making his monthly payments to the company. But the Zurich representative, who no longer works for the firm, said Gordon had signed a contract to deposit a certain amount each month and that he had to stick to it. Frustrated, Gordon pulled his money from Zurich and was levied a heavy penalty for doing so. Keen to take control of his money, Gordon opened an account with DBS Vickers, www.dbsvickers.com/pages/default.aspx in Singapore, to create a balanced, diversified account of exchange-traded index funds similar to the couch potato formula that Keith Wakelin, our previously profiled Canadian, was following. The main difference was that Gordon didn't know where he and Sue would eventually retire. Sue's family is in Singapore. Gordon's family is in Canada, and they own a piece of land in Hawaii. For that reason, Gordon thought it would be prudent to split his assets between Singaporean, Canadian, and other global stock and bond markets. Here's what their portfolio of exchange-traded fund indexes looks like. 20% in the Singapore Bond Index, ticker symbol A35. 20% in Singapore Stock Market Index, ticker symbol ES3. 20% in Canada's Short-Term Bond Index, ticker symbol XSB. 20% in Canada's Stock Market Index, ticker symbol XIC. 20% in the World Stock Market Index, ticker symbol VT. The first two indexes above trade on the Singaporean stock market. The following two trade on the Canadian Stock Exchange. And the last one, the World Stock Market Index, trades on the New York Stock Exchange. But you can purchase them all online using Singaporean brokerage firm DBS Vickers. Gordon and Sue rebalance their account with new purchases every month. For example, if the Singapore Bond Index hasn't done as well as the others, after a month it will represent less than 20% of their total investment. Remember that they've allocated 20% of their account for each of the five indexes. So when they add fresh money to their account, they would add to the Singapore Index. If the World Stock Index, the Canadian Stock Index, and the Singapore Stock Index have increased, leaving Gordon and Sue with less than 40% in their combined bond indexes, then they would add fresh money to the bond indexes when making their next investment. This ensures a couple of things. They are rebalancing their portfolio to increase its overall safety. They're buying the laggards, which over the long term will likely ensure higher returns. If you're interested in following step-by-step instructions on how to buy exchange-traded index funds in Singapore, you can access my website at the following, http://andrewhallam.com/2010/singaporeans-investing-cheaply-with-exchange-traded-funds. More Singaporeans are catching on. Always remember that the financial service industry's goal is to make money. For them, not for you. Not to miss the boat, Singaporeans are catching on to the benefits of low-cost investing. Financial blogger Kay Toh at MoneyTalk.sg compared the Singapore Straits Times Index Exchange Traded Fund performance, May 6, 2004 to May 6, 2009, with the Singapore Stock Market Unit Trusts available through Fund Supermart. You can see the results of each of the funds in Table 6.8. Table 6.8, Singapore Market Unit Trust Performances versus Singapore Stock Market Index, May 6, 2004 to May 6, 2009. As of May 6, 2009, UOB United Growth Fund, annualized returns over 5 years, 2.16%. Schroder Singapore Trust CLA, 2.21%. SGAM Singapore Dividend Growth, 6.1%. Lion Global Singapore Trust, 3.18%. HGIF Singapore EQA USD, -2.23%. DWS Singapore Equity Fund, 6.36%. DBS Shenton Thrift, -0.03%. Aberdeen Singapore Equity, 5.42%. The returns for the above funds include the effects of reinvested dividends. Singapore Straits Times Index Exchange Traded Fund, including dividends, 7.66%. Sources, Fund Supermart, Singapore Exchange, Street Tracks. Will some of the unit trusts have years where they beat the market index? Absolutely, but you don't know which ones will dominate, and no one else does either. Considering that no one can pick which unit trusts, actively managed funds, might outperform the indexes in the future, the educated investor doesn't bother with the gamble and follows Sue and Gordon's lead, building portfolios with low-cost indexes. Indexing in Australia, winning with an American weapon. 28-year-old Australian Nirav Bhatt makes his living doing something few people could have imagined possible just a decade ago. He's a full-time blogger. Sitting behind a computer screen for most of the day, Nirav says he does a lot more reading than writing. Constantly on the lookout for inspiration, he devours online articles to spark his creative energy, often giving him something to comment on for his own blog. His prolific reading exposed him to the superiority of index funds over actively managed mutual funds, known as unit trusts in Australia. Most financial advisors are just salespeople, and people are far too trusting of them, he says, explaining that most Australians just wander into a bank and buy their investment products, which generally charge nearly 2% a year in fees. After first reading a newspaper article on index funds, Nirav investigated further by studying a copy of Princeton University professor Burton Malkiel's classic book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. Then he discovered the American nonprofit investment company Vanguard, which had set up shop in his native Australia. Vanguard had been around for ages in Australia, but nobody was talking about it, he said. And Nirav recognized why. Most people get their financial knowledge and education from advisors who make their living selling high-cost products. Vanguard's the thorn in the side of an investment service community that wants to keep reaping as many fees as possible from unsuspecting investors. Nirav discovered that Australians can open accounts with Vanguard, and they can usually transfer their superannuation to Vanguard as well. Vanguard offers individual indexes for the Australian markets and the international markets, but one of the more cost-effective ways of investing with Vanguard Australia is with its life strategy funds. They are combinations of indexes, complete portfolios in a single fund, and the fee structure decreases as the account swells in value. Alternatively, if they built a portfolio of separate index funds through Vanguard Australia, they could feasibly end up paying much higher overall fees. That's because the fee structure is determined on the size of each fund, not on the size of each account. The more money an investor has in each fund, the lower the percentage fee. So an investor with $200,000 could pay a lot less with a Vanguard Australian Life Strategy Fund than he or she would by building a portfolio with separate Vanguard indexes. Table 6.9 reveals the relative costs. Table 6.9. Vanguard Australia's Life Strategy Fund Options, quoted in Australian dollars, showing Life Strategy index funds, allocation, and fees based on account size. Vanguard Life Strategy Conservative Fund, allocation, 70% bond indexes and cash, 30% Australian and international stock indexes. Fees, 0.9% on the first $50,000, 0.6% on the next $50,000, 0.35% on the balance above $100,000. Vanguard Life Strategy Balanced Fund, allocation, 50% bond indexes and cash, 50% Australian and international stock indexes. Fees, 0.9% on the first $50,000, 0.6% on the next $50,000, 0.35% on the balance above $100,000. Vanguard Life Strategy Growth Fund, allocation, 30% bond indexes and cash, 70% Australian and international stock indexes. Fees, 0.9% on the first $50,000, 0.6% on the next $50,000, 0.35% on the balance above $100,000. Vanguard Life Strategy High Growth Fund. Allocation, 10% bond indexes and cash, 90% Australian and international stock indexes. Fees, 0.9% on the first $50,000, 0.6% on the next $50,000, 0.35% on the balance above $100,000. Source, Vanguard Investments, Australia. The fund you choose will depend on your tolerance for risk. If you're interested in an allocation of bonds that's close to your age, then you could choose from the following respective funds. 1. Vanguard Life Strategy High Growth Fund, www.vanguard.com.au/personal_investors/investment/managed-funds-up-$2,000,500,000/diversified/high-growth.cfm. 10% bonds, 90% stocks. This is well suited for high-risk investors or investors in their late teens or 20s. 2. Vanguard Life Strategy Growth Fund, www.vanguard.com.au/personal_investors/investment/managed-funds-up-$2,500,000/diversified/growth.cfm. 30% bonds, 70% stocks. This benefits investors in their 30s and 40s. 3. Vanguard Life Strategy Balanced Fund, www.vanguard.com.au/personal_investors/investment/managed-funds-up-$2,500,000/diversified/balanced.cfm. 50% bonds, 50% stocks. Conservative younger investors or investors in their 50s and 60s might prefer the conservative nature of this fund, which still has capacity for growth with 50% allocated to stock indexes. 4. Vanguard Life Strategy Conservative Fund, www.vanguard.com.au/personal_investors/investment/managed-funds-up-$2,500,000/diversified/conservative.cfm. 70% bonds, 30% stocks. Retirees or extremely conservative investors might find this fund to be the right fit. Another word about risk. Investors with a corporate or government pension might not feel the need to invest so conservatively. For example, a 50-year-old school teacher with a pension might prefer to buy the growth fund instead of the conservative fund. Over time, the growth fund will likely do better, but the volatility will be higher. If someone has a strong alternative source of retirement income, then they might want to take a higher risk, higher return option. Nirav might be right when suggesting that most Australians are unaware of Vanguard. But one thing's for sure, there is economy in numbers. The more Australians who catch on to Vanguard, the cheaper its products will become. The next step. Once you learn how to build indexed accounts, the time commitment you will spend on making investment decisions and transactions will be minimal. You could end up spending less than 1 hour a year on your investments. Nobody is going to know how the stock and bond markets will perform over the next 5, 10, 20, or 30 years. But one thing is certain. If you build a diversified account of index funds, you'll beat 90% of professional investors. In a taxable account, you'll do even better. There's only one risk standing in the way of your investment success, and it's an ironic one. If you speak to an advisor at a financial institution, they will do their best to convince you to follow a higher cost, less effective option. In my next chapter, I'll reveal some of the tricks they use to keep investors away from index funds. Rule 7. Peek inside a pilferer's playbook. If you've read what I've written so far about indexed investing, I hope that you're planning to open your own indexed account. Or perhaps you'll want to find a fee-only advisor who can set it up for you. Either way, if you currently have a financial advisor buying you actively managed mutual funds, you're probably thinking of making the split. That might be easier said than done. I like to think that the majority of investors who have attended my seminars have decided to index their investments to save costs and taxes while building larger accounts than they would have done with baskets of less efficient products. But not all have. I know many would-be indexers spoke to their financial advisors, fully intending to break free, but the advisor sales pitch froze them in their tracks. Many financial advisors have mental playbooks designed to deter would-be index investors, and they initiate their strategies with remarkable success, metaphorically ensuring that their clients continue climbing Mount Kilimanjaro with 50-pound packs on their backs. How will most financial advisors fight you? Often, when a friend or family member wants to open an investment account, he or she asks me to come along. Beforehand, I briefly talk to the new investor about the markets, how they work, and the merits of index investing. I tell the person that every single academic study done on mutual fund investing points to the same conclusion. To give yourself the best possible odds in the stock market, low-cost index funds are key. Walking into a bank or financial service company, we're then settled into plush chairs across from a financial advisor selling us on the merits of his ability to choose actively managed mutual funds. When my friend brings up the merits of index funds, the salesperson has an arsenal of anti-index sales talk. Here are some of the rebuttals the advisors will give you. Desperate, of course, to keep money flowing into their pockets and the firm's. If you're prepared for what they might say, you'll have a better chance of standing your ground. Don't forget, it's your money, not theirs. Index funds are dangerous when stock markets fall. Active fund managers never keep all their eggs in the stock market in case it drops. A stock market index is linked 100% to the stock market's return. This is where a salesperson pushes a client's fear button, suggesting that active managers have the ability to quickly sell stock market assets before the markets drop, saving your mutual fund assets from falling too far during a crash. And then, when the markets are looking safer, or so the pitch goes, a mutual fund manager will then buy stocks again, allowing you to ride the wave of profits back as the stock market recovers. It all sounds good in sales theory, but they can't time the market like that, and hidden fees still take their toll. Ask your advisor to tell you which calendar year in recent memory saw the biggest decline. He should say 2008. Ask him if most actively managed funds beat the total stock market index during 2008. If he says yes, then you've caught him talking out the side of his head. A Standard & Poor's study cited in the Wall Street Journal in 2009 detailed the truth. The vast majority of actively managed funds still lost to their counterpart stock market indexes during 2008, the worst market drop in recent memory. Clearly, actively managed fund managers weren't able to dive out of the markets on time. What's more, a single stock market index is just part of a portfolio. Don't let an advisor fool you with data comparing a single index fund with the actively managed products they're selling. As you read in Chapter 5, smart investors balance their portfolios with bond indexes as well. You can't beat the market with an index fund, they'll say. An index fund will give you just an average return. Why saddle yourself with mediocrity when we have teams of people to select the best funds for you? I've heard this from a number of advisors, and it makes me smile. If the average mutual fund had no costs associated with it, no 12B1 fee, no expense ratio, no taxable liability, no sales commissions or advisor trailer fees, and no operational costs, then the salesperson would be right. A total stock market index fund's return would be pretty close to average. Long term, roughly half of the world's actively managed funds would beat the world stock market index, and roughly half of the world's funds would be beaten by it. But for that to happen, you would have to live in the following fantasy world. 1. Your advisor would have to work for free. No trailer fees or sales commissions for him or her or the firm. The tooth fairy would pay his mortgage, food bills, vacations, and other worldly expenses. 2. The fund company wouldn't make any money. Companies such as Raymond James, T. Rowe Price, Fidelity, Putnam Investments, Goldman Sachs, and the rest of the for-profit wealth management businesses would be charitable foundations. 3. The researchers would work for free. Not only would the fund companies bless the world with their services, but also their ranks of researchers would be altruistic, independently wealthy philanthropists giving their time and efforts to humanity. 4. The fund managers doing the buying and selling for the mutual funds would work for free. They would be so inspired by their parent companies that they would trade stocks and bonds for free while lesser evolved mortals worked for salaries. 5. The fund companies could trade stocks for free. Large brokerage firms would take the financial hit for the trading done by mutual fund companies. Recognizing the fund company's value-added mission, brokerage firms would pay every commission a fund company racked up from trading stocks. 6. Governments would waive your taxable obligations. Because the fund companies are such a blessing on the world's governments would turn a blind eye to the taxable turnover established. If the fantasy scenario above were correct, then yes, a total stock market index fund would generate very close to an average return. But in the real world, advisors suggesting that a total stock market index gives an average return are proving to be well-dressed Pinocchios or post-Columbus sailors with a flat earth complex. But a tough salesperson wouldn't give up there. Next, you might hear something like this. I can show you plenty of mutual funds that have beaten the indexes. We'd only buy you the very best funds. It's pretty easy to look in the rearview mirror at the last 15 winners of golf's British Open Championship and say, see, here are the champions who won the British Open over the past 15 years. These are people who can win. This knowledge qualifies me to pick the next 15 years' worth of champions, and will bet your money on my selections. Studies prove that high-performing funds of the past rarely continue their outperforming ways. Just look at the system used by Morningstar's mutual fund rating system. No one in the world has more mutual fund data than Morningstar. Certainly your local financial advisor doesn't. But as detailed in Chapter 3, the funds given top scores by Morningstar for their superb, consistent performance usually go on to lose to the market indexes in the following years. Even Morningstar recognizes the incongruity. John Rickenthaler, director of research, said in the fall 2000 edition of In the Vanguard, "To be fair, I don't think that you'd want to pay much attention to Morningstar's ratings either." So if Morningstar can't pick the top mutual funds of the future, what odds does your financial planner have, especially when trying to dazzle you with a fund's historical track record? If you're the kind of person who enjoys winding people up, try this comeback out the next time an advisor tries selling you or one of your friends on a bunch of funds that he claims have beaten the index over the past 15 years. Hey, that's great. They all beat the index over the past 15 years. Now, show me your personal investment account statements from 15 years ago. If you can show me that you owned all of these funds back then, I'll invest every penny I have with you. Okay, maybe that's a bit mean. You aren't likely to see any of those funds in his 15-year-old portfolio reports. If the salesperson deserves an A for tenacity, you'll get this as the next response. "But I'm a professional. I can bounce your money around from fund to fund, taking advantage of global economic swings and hot fund manager streaks, and easily beat a portfolio of diversified indexes." Just thinking about that kind of love gives me goosebumps. Many advisors will lead you to believe that they have their pulse on the economy, that they can foresee opportunities and pending disasters. Their sagacity, they will suggest, will enable you to beat a portfolio of indexes. But in terms of financial acumen, brokers and financial advisors are at the bottom of the totem pole. At the top, you have pension fund managers, mutual fund managers, and hedge fund managers. Most financial advisors, as U.S. personal finance commentator Susie Orman points out, are just pinstripe-suited salespeople. Your financial planner could have just a 2-week course under her belt. At best, a certified financial planner needs just 1 year of sales experience at a brokerage firm and fewer than 6 months of full-time academic training on investment products, insurance, and financial planning before receiving his or her certification. With some regular nightly reading, it wouldn't take long before you knew more about personal finance than most financial planners. They have to sell. They have to build trust. They have to make you feel good about yourself. These skills are the biggest part of their jobs. When arbitration lawyer Daniel Solon was writing his book, Does Your Broker Owe You Money?, a broker told him, "Training for a new broker goes something like this. Study and take the Series 7, 63, 65, and insurance exams. I spent 3 weeks learning to sell. If a broker wants to learn about asset allocation and diversification, it has to be done on the broker's own time." This might explain why it's often common to find investors of all ages without any bonds in their portfolios. Predominantly trained as salespeople, it's possible that many financial representatives aren't schooled in the practice of diversifying investment accounts with stocks and bonds. Noted U.S. finance writer William Bernstein echoes the gaps in most financial advisor training, suggesting in his superb 2002 book, The Four Pillars of Investing, that anyone who invests money should read the two classic texts. 1. A Random Walk Down Wall Street by Burton Malkiel. 2. Common Sense on Mutual Funds by John Bogle. After you're finished with these two books, you will know more about finance than 99% of all stockbrokers and most other finance professionals, he said. From what I've seen, he's right. When my good friend Dave Alfawicki and I went into a bank in White Rock, British Columbia in 2004, we met a young woman selling mutual funds. Dave wanted to set up an indexed account, and I went along for the ride. The advisor's knowledge gaps were extraordinary. So I asked the question, "What kinds of certification do you have and how long did it take?" She received her license to sell mutual funds through a course called Investment Funds in Canada, IFIC. It's supposed to take 3 weeks of full-time studying to complete the course, but she and her classmates finished it in just two intensive weeks. Before the two-week course, she knew nothing about investing. A year later, I went into another Canadian bank with my mom to help her open an investment account. We wanted the account to have roughly 50% in a stock index and 50% in a bond index. Of course, the advisor, as usual, tried talking us out of it. But once the advisor recognized that I knew more about investing than she did, she came clean. To paraphrase the discussion, she shocked us with this. First, we get a feel for the client. The bank suggests that if the client doesn't know much about investing, we should put them in a fund of funds. For example, a mutual fund that would have a series of funds within it. It tends to be a bit more expensive than regular mutual funds. This sales job only works with investors who really don't know what they're doing. If the investor seems a little smarter, we offer them individually our in-house brand of actively managed mutual funds. We don't make as much money with these, so we push for the other products first. Under no circumstances do we offer the bank's index funds to clients. If an investor requests them and we can't talk them out of the indexes, only then will we buy them for the client. I appreciated her candor. By the end of the conversation, the advisor was asking me for book suggestions about indexed investing, and she gratefully wrote down a number of titles. At least she was willing to take care of her personal portfolio. 3 years later, a different representative from the same bank phoned my mom. "Your account is too risky," he said. "Come on down to the bank so we can move some things around for you." Thankfully, my mom was able to stand her ground. With 50% of her investment in bond indexes, the account wasn't risky at all, but it wasn't profitable for the bank. If you notice a financial advisor has a university degree in finance, commerce, or business, hang tight for a moment. Find someone else with one of these degrees and ask this. During your studies at university, did you study mutual funds, index funds, or learn how to build a personal investment portfolio for wealth building or retirement? The answer will paradoxically be no. So don't be fooled by an additional irrelevant title. Most brokers and advisors really are just salespeople and well-paid salespeople at that. In the U.S., the average broker makes nearly $150,000 a year, putting them in the top 5% of all U.S. wage earners. They make more than the average lawyer, primary care doctor, or professor at an elite university. And if they're recommending actively managed funds, they're a bit like vendors in the guise of nutritionists selling candy, booze, and cigarettes. The totem pole view. Financial advisors and brokers are at the bottom of the totem pole of financial knowledge. At the top, you'll find hedge fund managers, mutual fund managers, and pension fund managers. Generally, earning the highest certification in money management as certified financial analysts, pension fund managers have the leeway to buy what they want. These are the folks managing huge sums of government and corporate retirement money. Arguably, they're the best of the best. If your local financial planner applied for the job of managing the pension for Pennsylvania's teachers or New Jersey's state pension system, he or she would likely get laughed off the table. Pension fund managers have their pulses on the stock markets and the economy. They can invest where they want. Typically, they don't have to focus on a particular geographic region or type of stock. The world is their oyster. If they want to jump into European stocks, they do it. If they think the new opportunities are in small stocks, they load up on those. If they feel the stock market is going to take a short-term beating, they might sell off some of their stocks, buying more bonds, or holding cash instead. Your typical financial planner isn't as knowledgeable as the average pension fund manager. But most advisors will try and sell you on the idea that, like the pension fund manager, they have their pulse on the economy and that they can find you hot mutual funds to buy. They might try telling you that they know when the economy is going to self-destruct, which stock market is going to fly, and whether gold, silver, small stocks, large stocks, oil stocks, or retail stocks are going to do well this quarter, this year, or this decade. But they are full of hot air. pension fund managers are more likely to know oodles more about making money in the markets than financial advisors or brokers. Knowing that pension fund managers are like the gods of the industry, how do their results stack up against a diversified portfolio of index funds? Most pension funds have their money in a 60-40 split, 60% stocks and 40% bonds. They also have advantages that retail investors don't have. Large company pension funds pay significantly lower fees than retail investors like you or I would, and they don't have to pay taxes on capital gains that are incurred. Considering the financial acumen of the average pension fund manager, coupled with the lower cost and tax benefits, you would assume that the average American pension fund would easily beat an indexed portfolio allocated similarly to most pension funds, 60% stocks and 40% bonds. But that isn't the case. U.S. consulting firm Future Metrics studied the performance of 192 U.S. major corporate pension plans between 1988 and 2005. Fewer than 30% of the pension funds outperformed a portfolio of 60% S&P 500 index and 40% intermediate corporate bond index. If most pension fund managers can't beat an indexed portfolio, what chance does your financial planner have? The best odds to win. If you told most financial advisors this, they would either begin talking in circles to confuse you, or they would desperately be battling with their ego. If it's the latter, you might hear this: if it were so easy, why wouldn't every pension fund be indexed? Pension fund managers are as optimistic as the rest of us. Many of them will try to beat portfolios comprised of a 60% stock index and a 40% bond index. But they aren't stupid, and many pension funds maximize their returns by indexing. According to U.S. financial advisor Bill Schulthess, author of The New Coffeehouse Investor, the Washington State Pension Fund, for example, has 100% of its stock market assets in indexes. California has 86% indexed. New York has 75% indexed, and Connecticut has 84% of its stock market money in indexes. The vast majority of regular everyday investors, however, about 95% of individual investors, buy actively managed mutual funds instead. Unaware of the data, their financial advisors distort realities to keep their gravy trains flowing. It will cost most people more than half of their retirement portfolios thanks to fees, taxes, and dumb market timing mistakes. Sticking with index funds might be boring, but it beats winding up as shark bait, and it gives you the best odds of eventually growing rich through the stock and bond markets. Is government action required? David Swensen, Yale University's endowment fund manager, suggests the U.S. government needs to stop the mutual fund industry's exploitation of individual investors. The U.S. has some of the lowest-cost actively managed funds in the world. I wonder what he would think of Canada's costs, Great Britain's costs, or Singapore's costs, all of which are significantly higher. You can't wait for government regulation. The best weapon against exploitation is education. You might not have learned this in high school, but you're learning it now. Among those hearing the call to arms and taking action to educate others is Google's Vice President, Jonathan Rosenberg. In August 2004, Google shares, www.google.com/intl/en/about/corporate/company, became available on public stock exchanges, and many Google employees who already held Google shares privately became overnight millionaires when the stock price soared. The waves of cascading wealth on Google's employees attracted streams of financial planners from firms such as J.P. Morgan Chase, www.jpmorgan.com, UBS, www.ubs.com, Morgan Stanley, www.morganstanley.com, and Presidio Financial Partners, www.thepresidiogroupllc.com. Drawn like sharks to blood, they circled Google, wanting to enter the company's headquarters so they could sell actively managed mutual funds to the newly rich employees. Google's top brass put the financial planners on hold. Employees were then presented with a series of guest lecturers before the financial planners were allowed on company turf. According to Mark Dowie, who wrote about the story for San Francisco Magazine in 2008, the first to arrive was Stanford University's William Sharp, the 1990 Nobel laureate economist. He advised the staff to avoid actively managed mutual funds. Don't try to beat the market. Put your money in some indexed mutual funds. A week later, Burton Malkiel arrived. The professor of economics at Princeton University urged the employees to build portfolios of index funds. He has been studying mutual fund investing since the early 1970s, and he vehemently believes it's not possible to choose actively managed funds that will beat a total stock market index over the long term. Don't believe anyone, a broker, advisor, friend, or magazine, suggesting otherwise. Next, the staff was fortunate enough to hear John Bogle speak. A champion for the little guy, John Bogle is the financial genius who founded the nonprofit investment group Vanguard. His message was the same. The brokers and financial advisors swimming around Google's massive raft have a single purpose. They're a giant fleecing machine wanting to take your money through high fees, and you may not realize what is happening until it's too late. When the sharks finally approached the raft, staff members at Google were armed to the teeth, easily fending off the well-dressed, well-spoken, charming advisors. I hope that you'll be able to do the same as the crew at Google. But don't forget that for most financial advisors, index funds are pariahs. If you have an advisor today and you're not invested in index funds, then you already know, based on their absence in your portfolio, that your advisor has a conflict of interest. In that case, asking your advisor how he feels about indexes is going to be a waste of time. After one of my seminars on index funds, I often hear someone say, "I'm going to ask my advisor about index funds." That's like asking the owner of a McDonald's restaurant to tell you all about Burger King. They won't want you stepping anywhere near the Whopper. And they certainly won't want you paying attention to the leader of Harvard University's endowment fund, Jack Meyer. When interviewed by William C. Simons in 2004 for Bloomberg Business Week, he said, "The investment business is a giant scam. It deletes billions of dollars every year in transaction costs and fees. Most people think they can find fund managers who can outperform, but most people are wrong. You should simply hold index funds. No doubt about it." Clearly, investing in index funds is a way to statistically ensure the highest odds of investment success. Doing so, however, means that you will need to stand your ground and perhaps take the road less traveled, while most people succumb to the impressive sales rhetoric that leads them toward, at the very least, investment mediocrity with actively managed mutual funds. If you want to grow rich on an average salary, you can't afford to invest in the expensive products sold by most financial advisors. A huge risk, however, is when investors start looking at options to enhance their investment returns even further than what an index portfolio would provide. The following chapter outlines some common mistakes that people make, with a strong message to avoid the same mistakes yourself. Rule 8. Avoid seduction. The trouble with taking charge of your own finances is the risk of falling for some kind of scam. Learning how to beat the vast majority of professional investors is easy. Invest in index funds. But some people make the mistake of branching off to experiment with alternative investments. Achieving success with a new financial strategy can be one of the worst things to happen. If something works out over a 1, 3, or 5 year period, there's going to be a temptation to do it again, to take another risk. But it's important to control the seductive temptation of seemingly easy money. There's a world of hurt out there and rascals keen to separate you from your hard-earned savings. In this chapter, I'll examine some of the seductive strategies used by marketers out for a quick buck. With luck, you'll avoid them. Confession time. Perhaps I'm justifying this to feel better about myself, but this is what I believe. Any investor who doesn't have a story relating to a really dumb investment decision is probably a liar. So I'm going to roll up my sleeves and tell you about the dumbest investment decision I ever made. It might prevent you from making a similar silly mistake. The dumbest investment I ever made. In 1998, a friend of mine asked me if I would be interested in investing in a company called Instacash Loans. "They pay 54% annually in interest," he whispered, "and I know a few guys who are already invested and collecting interest payments." For any half-witted investor, the high interest rate should have raised red flags. Around that time, I was reading about the danger of high-paying corporate bonds issued by companies such as WorldCom, which was yielding 8.3%. The gist of the warning was this: if a company is paying 8.3% interest on a bond in a climate where 4% is the norm, then there has to be a troublesome fire burning in the basement. Not long after WorldCom issued its bonds, the company declared bankruptcy. It was borrowing money from banks to pay its bond interest. The 54% annual return that my friend's investment prospect paid was a Mount Everest of interest compared with WorldCom's speed bump. It rightfully scared me to think of how crazy the investment venture must be, telling my friend as much. "Look," I said, "Instacash Loans isn't really paying you 54% interest. If you give the company $10,000 and the company pays out $5,400 at the end of the year in interest, you've only received slightly more than half of your investment back. If that guy disappears into the Malaysian foothills with that $10,000, you get the shaft. You'd lose $4,600. It seemed totally crazy, but what's even crazier is that I eventually changed my mind. After the first year, my friend told me that he had received his 54% interest payment. "No, you didn't," I insisted. "Your original money could still vaporize." The following year, he received 54% in interest again, paid out regularly with 4.5% monthly deposits into his bank account. Although I still thought it was a scam, my conviction was losing steam. It appeared that now he was ahead of the game, receiving more in interest than he had given the company in the first place. He increased his investment to $80,000 in Instacash Loans, which paid him $43,200 annually in interest. As a retiree, he was able to travel all over the world on these interest payments. He went to Argentina, Thailand, Laos, and Hawaii, all on the back of this fabulous investment. After about 5 years, he convinced me to meet the head of this company, Daryl Klein, and yes, that's his real name. How was Instacash Loans able to pay out 54% in interest every year to each of its investors? I wanted to know how the business worked. I drove to the company's headquarters in Nanaimo, British Columbia, with a friend who was also intrigued. Pulling alongside the curb in front of Daryl's office, I was skeptical. Daryl was standing on the sidewalk in a creased shirt with his sleeves rolled up, a cigarette in hand. We settled into Daryl's office and he explained the business. Initially, he had intended to open a pawn brokerage, but changed his mind when he caught on to the far more lucrative business of loaning money and taking cars as collateral. As a result, Instacash Loans was created. In a narrative recreation, this is what he said: "I loan small amounts of short-term money to people who wouldn't ordinarily be able to get loans. For example, if a real estate agent sells a house and knows he has a big commission coming and he wants to buy a new stereo right away, he can come to me if his credit cards are maxed out and if he doesn't have the cash for the stereo." "How does that work?" I wanted to know. "Well, if he owns a car outright and he turns the ownership over to me, I'll loan him the money. The car is just collateral. He can keep driving it, but I own it. I charge him a high interest rate plus a pawn fee, and if he defaults on the loan, I can legally take the car. When he repays the loan, I give the car's ownership back." "What if they just take off with the car?" I asked. "I have some great retired ladies working for me who are fabulous at tracking down these cars. One guy drove straight across the country when he defaulted on the loan. One of these ladies found out that he was in Ontario, about a six-hour flight from Daryl's office in British Columbia, and before the guy even knew it, we had that car on the next train for British Columbia. In the end, we handed him the bill for the loan interest plus the freight cost for his car. It sounded like a pretty efficient operation to me, but I wanted to know if the guy had a heart. "Hey, Darryl," I asked, "have you ever forgiven anyone who didn't pay up?" Leaning back in his chair with a self-satisfied smile, Darryl told the story of a woman who borrowed money from him, using the family motorhome as collateral. She defaulted on the loan, but she didn't think it was fair that Darryl should be able to keep the motorhome. Her husband had not known about the loan. He came into Darryl's office with a lawyer,